Okay, I guess now that the shadows are encroaching, we can start again. At some point, Renee asked me to risk a synthesis, or at least a subjective overview of what's been said, or the salient points that have been come up in the course of the day. Maybe we can do that collectively. But being as we ended on the question of performing lurkership, so to speak, I'd like to draw out the remaining lurkers in the group. Tushar. In a sense, so that there doesn't appear to be a monopolization in this corner of the room. Would you object to me asking you to open this next session? Okay. I just wanted to make, everyone is laughing because despite the fact that I'm a self-described slacker, assigned everyone some homework, asking everyone to come equipped with a little bit of vocabulary, and I wouldn't want people to feel frustrated that they didn't have an opportunity to voice those words. So do feel free, of course, at every moment to jump into the conversation. There's something that was brought up, and it was a very interesting point. It was right at the beginning, where you were saying that in an earlier moment in Rack's history, you also worked on lexicons. And you acknowledged that the production of lexicons often comes at a moment of a knowledge crisis, or a perceived knowledge crisis. I don't know if you would agree with me, but I noticed that more and more often now, I'm finding glossaries at the end of relatively short books. I was looking the other day at the recent English translation of Jacques Rancière's The Politics of Aesthetics, I think it's called in English. Short essay, in fact it was originally an interview given in French, which he fleshed out into a text. But about one third of that book is devoted to a definition of the terms that he's using in it. And of course, Rancière does have about 40 years of publication behind him, and he has developed a conceptual vocabulary that was actually very nicely unpacked in that glossary. But nevertheless, it's unusual to accompany an interview with a definition of the terms that are being used in it. Although I found it was very heuristic, in other words, very eye-opening to have this lexical tool available. But I was wondering if you and Monica actually maybe just, rather than getting into the intricacies or the theory of the lexicon, could it describe what it was that motivated you to get down to the nuts and bolts of defining words, or first of all, choosing a set of words, and then how you went about trying to define them, whether you dug about in other secondary literature, whether you divided your labor and each took a certain number of words, whether you worked together collectively, or was it a sort of an arrangement amongst those things, and why it is you didn't pursue a long-term career in lexicon building. Monica, do you want to start?
We have words which we'll talk about later that I've brought something to the table for the lexicon. But asking about the lexicon, what we had written, the thing we've written is called the Concise Lexicon for and of the Digital Commons. And it's 26 entries A to Z. written in 2001. It feels so long ago that it's almost hard to kind of recuperate what it is that was going on. But I think broadly the idea was, see, the thing is, it's very difficult to translate this into a narrative that is linear. So it's not a linear narrative. Why one arrives at something like a set of entries for a possible expandable lexicon is, as we were talking about earlier today, as I was trying to say, that you want to make sense of your practice and do your practice and make sense of thinking about it. I mean, both levels of things. How does one understand one's practice, and how does one try and understand the what one considers one's own philosophy behind one's practice? And we could read out some of the entries to you, and I think it might be quite interesting, because what we were trying to do in that was, we took two worlds, the real world and the virtual world. The city as the context that we are part of, and in 2001, the new context, which was the virtual context, the online context, which was becoming something that we were becoming part of. And I think in 2001, it was still pretty early days. And already the question was, at that time, people assumed that they were sort of disaggregate, you know, there were separate things. There was the real world, and then there was the virtual world. I think there's been much more porosity in ways of finding metaphors or analogies since then. But for us, it became a kind of a heuristic exercise for oneself. You find a word to propel oneself to think further, but it was really to find connections and ways of thinking between the real and the virtual. And I think some of it will only make sense if perhaps we read some of the entries that we did or the words that we found. Hyperlinked lexicon in which words were cross-referencing each other. And I can't remember all of them, but Shuddha is now going to tell you some of the entries. I mean, I know that E was for ensemble, and I think it's better if we start from the beginning and maybe have a little bit of what was in there. We can, it's online actually, but I can't put it on screen. It's just text. So, but it might be easier to read if...
It's just text,
there's no visual, even though it's on. I could put it on the screen, but it's text. We'll just connect it.
There's two or three things about building lexicons that's interesting. One is that it forces you to build entries for at least 26 concepts if you're lucky to be speaking an English language. I won't speak for Chinese dictionaries, because I think that if one wanted to make a lexicon in Chinese, then the number of concepts would be dependent on the number of radicals, which is an incredibly complex issue. But at least 26 unrepeating, unique, discrete items. And the thing about language is that you can't actually... A dictionary is a machine in which you define a word or a thought by other thoughts or other words. So you're actually forcing language to do work that, you know, to do its own work for you when you produce something. And in this case, the conceit of the lexicon was, as Monica mentioned, a hyperlinking strategy, where every word had to be defined in this lexicon. For instance, there was a word, nodes. In order to define it, we had to use at least some of the other words in the lexicon, because otherwise a lexicon or a dictionary doesn't make sense. A dictionary only makes sense if it is an internally generating self-referential mechanism. So building a dictionary is like actually creating a universe, because you set certain concepts in motion, and then you use those concepts to refine the content of the concepts themselves, which is kind of an interesting, playful, it can be an interestingly playful thing to do. And the thing about this particular lexicon and its other conceit was that it took words from the vocabulary of digital technology. So there were words like nodes, there were words like, there were several other words. Bandwidth, for instance, was another word. Data was another word. You used the data entry, I remember. And we turned around these words that have a certain ubiquity in digital language in order to speak actually of completely other things. So the entry on data, maybe we can... Yeah, so there were code, data, ensemble. Can you read the entry on data? Yeah. Don't go through the whole thing. It's just... it'll.
Access, bandwidth, code, data.
But read the entry on data. It's an interesting one to read.
Okay. Information can mean anything from numbers to images, from white noise to sound. A weather report, a portrait, a shadow in surveillance footage, a salary statement, birth and death statistics, a headcount in a gathering of friends, private email, ultra-high frequency signals, sale and purchase transactions, and the patterns made by pedestrians as they walk in a city. All of this can be and is data. Data, like coal, uranium, and other minerals vital to the running of the world economy, is mined, processed, refined, and sold at a high price. Battlefields, early 21st century interpersonal relationships, and stock exchanges have been known to be hypersensitive to data traffic. Data mining is a major emerging industry in Delhi. The miners lead very quiet days and spend long nights coding in low temperature zones called data outsourcing centers. Contrarily, the word data in Hindi Sanskrit, data, in Hindi Sanskrit is taken to mean giver, which suggests that one must always be generous with information and make gifts of our code, images, and ideas. To be stingy with data is to violate an instance of the secret and sacred compacts of homophonic words from different cultural spatial orbits. Data in Hindi and data in English, as they meet in the liminal zone between languages, in the thicket of the sound of quotidian slips of the tongue. Errors in transmission and understanding, too, carry gifts and data. I'd just like to note, parenthetically, that the word in French for data is the word to give, donner. Now, node. You want me to read node?
Yep.
Nodes, in actually plural, any structure that is composed of concentrated masses of materials which act as junction points for the branching out of extensible parts of the overall system may be described as nodal. The concentrations or junctions being the nodes. A nodal structure is a rhizomic structure. It sets down roots that branch out laterally as it travels. Here, nodes may also be likened to the intersection points of fractal systems, the precise locations where new fractal iterations arises out of an existing pattern. A work that is internally composed of memes is inherently nodal. Memes, is that the correct pronunciation?
Memes.
Exactly, so it's in
kind of
cross-referential. Each meme is a junction point or a node for the lateral branching out of the vector of an idea. In a work that is made up of interconnected nodes, the final structure that emerges is that of a web in which every vector eventually passes through each node at least once on its orbit through the structure of the work. In such a structure, it becomes impossible to suppress or kill an idea once it is set in motion because its vectors will make it travel quickly through the nodes to other locations within the system, setting off chains of echoes and resonances at each node that trace a path back to the kernel of the idea. These echoes and resonances are recensions, and each node is ultimately a direct recension of at least one other node in the system and an indirect recension of at least of each junction within a whole cluster of other nodes. Nodes, when written, perhaps erroneously, as nodes, gives rise to an intriguing hybrid English Eastern Hindi neologism, a comparison to the old words des and pardes. Des in some Eastern dialects of Hindi spoken by many migrants to Delhi is simply homeland or native place. Pardes suggests exile and an alien land. No des is that state, site or way of being in des or in pardes where territory and anxieties about belonging don't go hand in hand. Nodes in a digital domain are no des.
So the whole method of the dictionary was to create these, through a kind of hyperglossia, an overproduction of speech and words, effects that were quite independent of the specific meaning of the word that you thought you encountered when you produced it. I mean, we've been quite interested in the overproduction of information. There's another work that we did called Ectropy Index, which is, ectropy is the opposite of entropy. If entropy is the tendency of things to devolve into sort of chaos, ectropy is the production of, is the hyperproduction of order. So a lexicon is typically an ectropic enterprise, but it's premised on its own failure. It will have so many meanings that you can't actually say what it is. And in this lexicon, very many meanings are constructed by a kind of dance between one meaning of the word and another meaning of the word. So that what you produce is actually some completely third register, which is what I think I was beginning to talk about in this morning, is that dictionaries, by their precision, produce semantic chaos. I mean, because we've actually done a fair amount of work on the history of dictionaries, the Noah Webster dictionary, which is now considered a kind of really interesting definitive dictionary for American English, when it was first, the second edition of the Webster's dictionary produced complete chaos. People were up in arms at the fact that this dictionary actually made it more difficult to say what many common terms were. And there, people were really upset that the dictionary which should clarify language ended up confusing it. Not because the lexicographers of the Webster's dictionary produced really difficult meanings or produced difficult words, but they layered every entry with so many different kinds of meaning that it became impossible to say what, let's say, the word regret meant. Is regret something you have before, after, and so many other words. There are many other words in English which have this double, triple, quadruple-sided meanings, and lexicons really do that. So, I mean, when you are if we are engaged in the production of naming, then I think we need to understand that we are really engaged in the production of ambiguity. That's one reason to do dictionaries, actually.
So how do you see the future of this lexicon list?
Monica, can you talk about LexWiki and what happened?
Well, we had certain hopes. The hopes were that it would be an expandable lexicon. And we tried very hard to set up something called the LexWiki, which is that you could make new entries for each letter. You could either make a new entry for A, or you could modify the first entry to make a recension. And supposing you made a recension of a recension, you could watch the history of each recension, and you could make new entries which could create their own recensions. So kind of ever-expanding fractal possibility for each word. Coding problems. So, but the idea was fundamentally an expandable lexicon, and it was set up in a university context once, and there were a number of other entries, but I think it requires, this is the one thing one realizes, that you have to, it's not just enough to set up, like to set up a platform or something, it's not enough to just make a building, as Prayas and I were discussing today. The next thing is how that building comes alive. Which is the same thing, you can't just set up something online and then you've got to help it become more, which we could not manage to do. But the idea was fundamentally extensible, but our entries are only 26. We only made the first 26 entries. And it's open for anyone to take and change it and so on and so forth.
One thing it might be interesting to point out, one of the key entries in this dictionary is the word recension. Could you read recension?
recension, a retelling, a word taken to signify the simultaneous existence of different versions of a narrative within oral and from now onwards digital cultures. Thus one can speak of a southern or a northern recension of a myth, or a female or male recension of a story, or the possibility to begin with of Delhi, Berlin, Tehran recensions of digital work. The concept of recension is contraindicative of the notion of hierarchy. A recension cannot be an improvement, nor can it connote a diminishing of value. A recension is that version which does not act as a replacement for any other configuration of its constitutive materials. The existence of multiple recensions is a guarantor of an idea or a work's ubiquity. This ensures that the constellation of narrative, signs, and images that a work embodies is present and waiting for iteration at more than one site at any given time. Recensions are portable and they're carried within orbiting kernels within a space. Recensions, taken together, constitute ensembles that may form an interconnected web of ideas, images, and signs.
Was to challenge in some ways the obsession with newness in new media. And we're by now quite happy that this has sort of ended. Nobody actually talks about new media anymore. And we're very happy that this has happened. Because the idea of newness sets up an implicit hierarchy where the latest thing is always somehow more interesting than the one that has followed it. And especially when you have a situation where things haven't had the time to actually make their presence felt in the world, it becomes kind of neurotic to constantly look for the next version of your wetware, software, whatever it is. So for us, it's not as if this doesn't mean that you don't change. You change and you transform and you produce from the common pool of materials that we all have, but it doesn't create new versions. It creates recensions. And it's a term that's actually used in philology a lot, where you look at, and there's a reference to the act of translation here, which is quite interesting and important. And if one looks at the Brahmaputra Valley in this kind of stretch, this is a corridor of translation. A lot of texts from, let's say, the Buddhist Sanskrit canon were taken up this river by Chinese and Tibetan travelers who came here, who came down this river and translated. And it is their translation that has actually ensured their survival. So now, for instance, we reconstruct what is called Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit or Buddhist Sanskrit texts from the fact that Tibetans and Chinese scholars and monks translated them. And while translating them, also produced, during the act of translation, lexicons and glossaries. So for every term that they use, and Buddhist philosophy is incredibly technically complicated, there is a dictionary and there is a dictionary entry. So now we can actually reconstruct the Sanskrit original, which is dead. India doesn't have it. There isn't a tradition of Buddhist learning in India that is able to produce it because it was translated into Chinese by being taken up this river. So in a sense, the presence of a recension guaranteed the future survival of the original. And I mean, we were producing this at a time when a lot of people had a great deal of anxieties about the relationship between copies and originals. I think we're past that now, and people are less insecure about the relationship between copies and originals, and less insecure about intellectual property. But at that time, it seemed a great anxiety, so we wanted to sort of produce a term that could help us think through that.
And in a way, also connected to the question of authorship. I mean, the whole thing about the idea of a recension is that if you and we also made another online platform called Opus, which was it was kind of slightly smart aleckly called open platform for unlimited signification. The whole idea was that you put something online and that it can be used to make new recensions. It wasn't, and you could watch the history of each recension because it would be shown visually as well as in text as well as in visual terms. It could display that for you. But the whole idea was, and I think it's again speaking to an anxiety which was much more active at that time, but I was just remembering a conversation yesterday, the sort of anxiety about the notion of authorship. And that's why we were trying to say, separate the notion of, A, like in the new media world, or at least in the kind of the technology world, the word version was so important. This is version 1.0, 1.1. And it refused, you know, so it seemed like this, which Shuddha was talking about, a certain trajectory that was we found limiting. And the other one was the idea of obsessive relationship with authorship, which was that only I can produce something, and it sort of begins and ends with me. And so this was trying to address both online and offline kind of anxieties. And I think the whole lexicon is actually reflective of that time and place of being in Delhi in the early 2000s.
So what it did for us was to produce a kind of... this was an exercise undertaken as self-clarification and as a kind of autodidactic impulse. We were teaching ourselves the concepts with which we would work. And I think looking back on this moment, it's actually quite interesting to realize that by doing this, we didn't freeze the meaning of our practice. We actually opened it out to generate a certain kind of impetus that would see us through for a while. So knowing that you could think about the relationship to work in a quite personal way without being anxious about authorship is not an automatic step. It doesn't come of and by itself. You have to actually think it through. And I think exercises like that sort of have that function of producing a certain set of horizons that you didn't have before you did them. So it does sit at the basis of a lot of what other things that we've done. So in a sense, is it a text or is it an artwork? We've always located this as one of the works that we did, not one of the texts that we've written, because it's generative of possibilities of other work, in a sense.
Just looking at it now, I see that, to respond to what you just said, it does have that characteristic of an artwork, which is the characteristic of self-referentiality. I mean, even in the three entries which we just looked at, it's very clear that there is that sort of tautological imperative that it must refer back to itself constantly, even as it refers outwards into the world. Because, of course, to come back to the notion of usership and where philosophically that idea comes from, in the 20th century, it was the philosophy of Wittgenstein and his followers that developed the notion of, what Wittgenstein himself called the usership theory of language. In other words, meaning was not some sort of pristine thing which was contained in a lexicon somewhere that it just hadn't been written or that God alone had access to, but which was actually produced by a community of language users. And of course, this is what a lexicon attempts to do. It attempts to, I think, an interesting lexicon, one like this, which is at once idiosyncratic in the literal sense of that term, and also an attempt a self-didacticism or a...
Clarificatory.
Yes, self-clarification, pointing the way forwards, is that it has a certain disruptive value amongst a community of language users. It doesn't so much clarify things as it disrupts what's sometimes referred to as ordinary language use, which can be all too ordinary. And sometimes when people say, could you be more clear, or could you give me an example? I mean, sometimes it's just because we're being lazy and sloppy, or because we don't really know what we're talking about. But oftentimes it can be a real strategy, too, to have that disrupt, to force a breach in an otherwise all too smooth surface. But to come back to this notion of, ultimately, we are all members of that... a certain group of users, in as much as we are language users. And what I'm trying to say is that when we read a text which is really, that really will count, it always will have develop this kind of software. It will systematically use words that are at the limit of their in a very sort of tense way, a little bit stressing the struggling